This is Claudio Speakeasy in Radio Theatre. Got a real treat for us. Got a man that probably needs no introduction, even though I'm going to introduce him, and that's film director Michael Babbitt. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, everyone.
I'll make sure you're coming across there. By the way, Bob, can you hear yourself in your mic yet? So fiddle with those if need be, but we're trying to figure some things out here in the studio. I just want to give a quick shout-out to the historic Carolina Theatre. I just worked the full-frame documentary film festival, and it was a real treat. I've become quite convinced that documentary film seems to be the modern-day bohemia, where people talk about things, stir things up, and maybe even get movements going.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah, I'm absolutely impressed by the status that documentaries have taken on, because we were a sellout the entire time at Carolina Theatre. So I enjoyed soaking that up for 4 days. Bob, you want to cue us in as to what's happening with the Apex Arts Council?
Oh, the Apex Arts Council is, as always, doing all kinds of fun stuff. We're planning a number of shows for this year. The first one that we're planning, if I can get a couple of extra things done, will be over the 4th of July weekend, and that's our regular show of patriotic art and things of that nature. Anything that anyone has, if you contact me, if you're an artist, we'll see about putting you in. Then we got a few other things for the rest of the year. But, of course, the big deal in Apex comes the first Saturday in May, which I believe is May 3rd this year, and that's Peak Fest.
Right.
The big black party, a block party, and we'll have a great old time there. I'll be there, and I think, Claudia, I think you're going to join me at the table,
I'm going to be hanging out, yeah.
Yeah.
I figure with all the stuff that the Apex Arts Council has done for me, I owe.
So. Yeah. So if you want to meet both of us or get a signed autograph from Claudio or something like that, definitely come on down to Peak Fest and come see us.
Signed autograph from me.
Yeah, well, you know.
Perish the thought.
Yeah, somebody might want that.
You know. I just got one.
No time.
Yeah,
that's right.
Right,
you did.
Okay.
It's funny, it made me think of an experience I had with Joan Baez at the Carolina Theater. About a decade ago, I was chefing in a restaurant called Luma's Macrobiotic Vegetarian Gourmet Restaurant on 22nd and 9th in New York City. And we just fed a table consisting of Madonna, Yoko Ono, Sean Lennon, Lenny Kravitz, Joan Baez, and I can't remember. There are a few others there, big names. And Joan Baez came into the kitchen because she was so impressed with the food to come and thank the chef. But she came in a sailor's jacket that she'd obviously gotten from John Lennon. I mean, not John Lennon. What am I saying? Sean Lennon. That she'd gotten from her Bob Dylan days. Sorry, let me get my story straight here, when they were dating many moons ago. But anyway, and it was my instinct to sort of ask her while she was back in there, since she was thanking me for the food. I wanted to really ask her for an autograph, but something told me, no, this is not the time. This would not be cool. So a decade later, this was actually more than 10 years back, a decade later, I'm working at the Carolina Theater as stage manager. She is doing a sound check. And I figured, okay, this is prime time. I'm going to see if I can hit her up this time. In the meantime, I'd actually seen a documentary with her and Bob Dylan both being totally against signing autographs. It's religiously opposed. So I just didn't come to the surface of my memory at the time. So after we did a couple of sound check numbers, I walked up to her and I said, I wonder if I might get your autograph. And she gave me this very cold response saying, I really appreciate this, but I think that's, you know, that's insulting. And not that I had insulted her, but she just felt that it was, you know, why are we supposed to think we're so much better than you are by giving you autographs and so on? And I just sort of left it alone for a minute. And I said, well, I just thought I'd try. And she said, I appreciate it, but no. And then I started walking off stage, and I remember the time that she came into the kitchen, 22nd and 9th. Turns out it's one of her hangouts. And I went back and said, I wonder if you remember about a decade or more, you came into the kitchen, you were on the table with, gave her the whole rundown of who was at the table. You guys were doing an album against the Persian Gulf War. And you came back in and raving about the food. And I wonder if you remember I was the chef that night. And she kind of looks me up and down. She goes, that was you, wasn't it? I said, yeah, I'm wondering, would that do me any good to get your autograph? And she goes, Claudio! And I went, okay. And I started walking backstage, just leaving the stage. And I'm halfway across the stage. She goes, Claudio, go get me a Pepsi and I'll sign the damn thing. And I got her picture and had her sign it. So I'm one of the few people that has an autograph.
Cool.
Took me a decade to get it.
It's great.
I just had to throw that in there. I apologize,
no,
folks.
That's great.
Got carried away. But anyway, I want to acknowledge the historic Carolina Theater as my underwriter and also the rather historic Apex Arts Council as well.
Yeah, we're historic or hysterical. I don't know.
You'll get really historic once you get ancient.
Yeah. Well,
I think that's how it works.
Next year is 10 years, so.
Oh, okay. So you're getting close.
We're getting close.
A decade's worth of history.
Yeah, getting there.
So, Michael, Welcome to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. I'm sorry I messed up last week. He was actually here waiting for me, and I got called away to some legal affairs of my father's estate.
That is not a problem at all. It's completely understandable.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I have looked at pictures and posters of your cinematic background, and you obviously are very involved in the art form. I know you have a background in theater as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion, I'm going to do this sort of in the artist studio style. My suggestion is, who are you? Why are you here? Go ahead and tell us some.
Wow.
Let's go back to your early influences and how you even got into film, and then we'll sort of do retro stuff.
Oh, okay. So, well, I guess I really first got introduced to film. You know, filmmakers my age, I came of age in the mid-70s to late 70s, early 80s, which mm-hmm. was sort of the birth of the blockbuster.
Pretty much,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, some of the first films that were really influential on me are movies like Jaws, Star Wars, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I'm naming a lot of Spielberg, mm-hmm, Lucas mm-hmm. stuff, but things like that. Alien.
That had an impact on the entire generation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, Ridley Scott's Alien.
Alien was one of my favorites, I have to say.
Oh, man, I love that movie.
I've got the whole collection.
That is a terrifying movie.
Yes, I thought so, too.
And, you know, today, you know, kids would watch that and go, oh, this isn't scary. What's so bad about this? And I'm like, wow. That says something about jaded.
Yeah, right. That's
kids
true.
Kids already are.
But just the thought of going to another planet and realizing that you may be dealing with other life forms. Right. You have no idea how these life forms are going to respond to your life form.
Right, right.
And what's going to be eating you?
Exactly. Yeah, really, really terrifying. So, but those were some of my early influences. And once, Star Wars, I would have to say, would definitely be the point where I looked at a film. I'd seen other films, but when I saw Star Wars, I was sitting in the theater, and I can tell you the theater, and I can tell you what chair I was sitting in. And I said to myself, that's what I want to do. And then, you know, obviously things grew from there.
Had you played around with any cameras or pictures or any background in using any of the instruments at all?
Not at that point, no. Okay. But when that happened, I was like, that's what I want to do. So, you know, over the next couple of years, I managed to track down a Super 8 millimeter film and attempted to film a Super 8 millimeter recreation of some of my favorite movies. And I don't think any of the footage from any of this exists anymore. I think it's all disappeared. Although, you know, like when I'm 60, my mom will probably bring out and say, I found these in a box.
What you did. Can't believe you're my son. Yes.
So that was the beginning. And then I got pulled away from film being the real love. I got pulled into acting. I actually, you know, started doing a little bit more acting, especially in high school, because it was actually at that time, you know, we weren't in this change in digital groundbreaking filmmaking abilities. We were.
Pardon me for one second. We are recording, right, Bob? Okay, just double checking. Go ahead.
Okay, we were. We didn't have, you know. It's much easier to get a hold of a camera today and go out. You can do it with your iPhone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's nuts. Make it, it's
right,
insane.
Right. Well, back then,
it just doesn't feel right filming things that light.
No, and I can't watch things on those either, but because it's too small.
Yeah.
So it was harder to get the opportunity. I mean, the first film that I actually made, I raised $1,200. I earned $1,200. To spend, because we needed 12 rolls of film,
mm-hmm.
and the cost of the film canister and to have it processed was going to be $100 for each
you're right,
canister.
I hear you.
So we got $1,200, and it was my money, and I paid $1,200 to do this. So everything else we got for free. Like getting the camera was for free, and you know, getting locations and getting.
Did you get sponsors to do this, or,
no,
or how'd you
no,
do?
No,
it?
No, we just got it for free, and we filmed it, and then. This was like the late 80s.
Hmm.
After I'd gotten out of the military and come back to go to college, and we filmed the film, shot it all, and then the cinematographer, who knew his stuff, said to take it to this location, to get it processed. So I was like, cool. So I looked that up online in the – not online, excuse me. I looked that up in the – because there was no online.
There was no online. Exactly.
I looked it up in the Yellow Pages, and I found the place, and I went and I delivered it, got it. And I called him, and I said, I dropped it off, and they said it'll be ready tomorrow. And he was like, it'll be ready tomorrow? That sounds a little early. Where did you drop it off at? Well, there was a – I don't remember the name of the chain, but it was like a Circuit City or a Best Buy kind of store.
Yeah.
And they did film processing like Walmart and stuff like that.
Usually slides and photographs.
Well, they did film because film was still a little, you know, people still did, you know, had their own cameras and stuff. So I dropped it off there and he goes, no, that's not where I told you to drop it off. And I said, that's the name of it, what you told me. Well, apparently there was a local place that had a very similar name.
Oh, no.
And they did professional jobs. We got the film back and it was all ruined.
Oh, shoot.
And they were like, oh, well, we're sorry. Well, here's 12 free rolls of film. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. It's great that you've just given me back my $1,200, but we spent all that. We can't just go out and reshoot
it.
Yeah,
ouch.
So we didn't end up reshooting it. So it's I think it's part – most of it's probably somewhere in the cinematographer's basement somewhere. Pat, if you're hearing this in Missouri, I want it.
He can pick you up on the internet, so you might get through.
Today, you know, I might be able to, like, get a hold of that, have it. Because what was ruined about it was when they ran it through the processing, you know, they didn't check to make sure that the gate was their gate was clean. Our gate was clean in the film camera, but they didn't make sure that it was clean, so it had all sorts of scratches and stuff like that. Might be able to get that digitally.
That's
fix
true.
That today. So,
enhanced, they call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but it's. I think I'd be afraid to show it to anybody because it's. It was.
And what was the name of this work?
Let Him Run.
Let Him Run. And what was the premise of it?
The premise was, I don't remember. It was about a
good premise. Is that like doing a show about nothing?
It was about a. I'm trying to remember now. It was about a. Is it about some guy who had a problem with these mafia type people that were chasing him down, and he had to try to get away with them, get away from something like that? I don't remember what it was about. I mean, it's this thing in 1989 or 1990 or something like that on Super 8, and then we made another film, and this one about a year later. This one of the guys that worked on the film worked at the local university, so he had access to their giant broadcast ENG cameras, video cameras,
right.
the 3/4 inch, the big three. So we got these for free.
Wow.
so we shot this film, and this one I just directed.
And you're saying this was video and not actual film? That sounds like real film.
Yeah, that was video.
Wow.
And we were editing it. We couldn't get – so we got the cameras for free. We shot it all. To edit it, the only time we could get in a 3/4 inch editing bay was also on the university campus, but we could only do it when it wasn't being used by the students and by all the other anybody else that had access during the day. So we would both get off our jobs at about 6 o'clock in the evening. We'd drive to campus, wait at campus, you know, we'd get something to eat, hang out until about 11 o'clock, and then we'd get in and we'd edit all night. This was back in the days that their nonlinear editors didn't exist yet. So this was back in the days where you put a tape in, you put two tapes in to edit. You recorded to one and then you fast forwarded to the next edit and stuff like that. So we did that. We spent, I think, like a week from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. every morning editing this thing. And eventually, that was the first really finished piece that actually, I mean, I have a bunch of other. Mm-hmm. Kind of unfinished pieces that just never got finished.
Is it something you were pleased with in the end?
At the time, yes.
Yeah, good.
I look at it now and I go, wow.
Growing patterns, no doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. The editors could really learn how to tighten shots in this one.
The editor was at one time seen as an artist unto him or herself.
I still think they are. And
I think
it's a shame that the ease of nonlinear editors that we've gotten. Yeah, I get people that ask me all the time, can you teach me how to use Final Cut Pro? And or can you teach me how to use Premiere? And I'm like, well, why don't you learn to edit first?
Right.
And then.
It's like telling the sailor to use a compass first, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's where the film started. That's how the film started. But I got pulled away into acting and. And I did a bunch of acting, especially in college.
Now, you had a theater company, right? What was the name of that?
Actually, two. One in Missouri and one here in Chapel Hill. It was called the one here was the Open Door Theater.
Okay, and the one in Missouri?
The Midwest Renaissance Theater Company.
All right.
Quite a mountain. We called it MRTC.
Pretty brave title there.
Well, that's
some stuff to live up to.
Yeah. Well, the Open Door was taken from a Peter Brook book called The Open Door, which is about theater, called The Open Door, that my fellow co-founder, we were both really enamored of. So, yep.
Wasn't the back door like, get out.
No. The back door, get out of here.
The whole Renaissance thing in Missouri, it sounds like you're bringing culture to those natives.
Well, we tried. I'm not sure how good our stuff was. This, to me, I mean, that's pre-grad school for me. So, for me as an artist, especially as an actor, that was in the days where I was writing only on talent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know.
A lot to be said for that.
Yeah, a lot to be said for that. And it's what got me into grad school, I think.
Ah.
But grad school is what helped me really understand not only the art part of it, but the craft part of it and how the two have to work together. And so after it is when I feel like I really came into my own as an artist.
Really? Fantastic. Yeah. Well, let's bounce around a little bit and tell us about some of the works, the professional works you have available now, to include, I forget the title of your most recent one, something Whisper.
Oh, The Endless Whispers?
The Endless Whispers.
Well, that's not yet available. We're filming that late fall of this year.
Give us some background as to, you know, what you've got out there now and, you know, where people can take a look at it.
Everybody, if you're interested in seeing some of my work and the works that I've done with other people, my personal website is bombshellstudios.com, and that's got all of my works from the past, except for the one I was just talking about. Let Him Run is not up there.
Let Him Run is not up there.
I'm not going to put that up there. But and then our current film, which is called The Endless Whispers, is at theendlesswhispers.com. And it's about that's mainly centered around the current film, but we do actually have a number of different things that are up there, including several featurettes, because we're shooting different featurettes about characters from the film itself that take place before the actual film takes place, so you can get to know some of the characters before you actually even go see the film.
Oh, perfect.
So
give us a profile on everything that you have accessible right now.
Well,
if I may say,
there's a lot.
Skip War and Peace.
War and Peace. Oh, man, but that's my favorite. No.
Right.
most of my short films are on bombshellstudios.com, and they go all the way back to when I decided to move back into film, which was 2007.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I decided, all right, you know what? I'm going to move away from the theater. I'm going to get out of the theater, get away from acting. I was doing a lot more directing in the theater anyway, so I wanted to – because I really want to direct. I knew I wanted to direct. That's, you know, when I wanted to make films, I wanted to direct films. And so I've always known that I've wanted to direct, and I've always gravitated towards directing. But the theater is an actor's medium.
Absolutely.
You know, the actor is really the true heart of the...
Visual only to the extent of the stage itself.
Yeah, yeah. But, and you know, and it's great. So, you know, when an actor, when a piece was directed, I had a lot of actors that would get mad at me. Because when I was finished directing a piece, I would see it opening night, and then I wouldn't go back because I was done.
Sure, I totally understand.
My
that.
Work was completely done, and I wanted them to have it, and they needed to make it theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, having whatever presence, you know, whatever, you know, having me sitting in the audience and them having to worry about that.
Would you come back toward the end of the run?
No.
Take another look? No?
I hadn't, because, I mean, theater is such a, if we had had shows that might have run like 6 months,
mm-hmm.
I probably could have. But, you know, we ran shows for like 3, maybe 4 weeks.
Gotcha,
and
right.
I was still way too close to it. And I always felt like I would go back and it would be disappointing to me because I would see the changes they would make and I would be, you know, upset about that. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, you know, I don't want to do that to the actors at all because it's their piece. It's, you know, they got to breathe the life into it.
Right, exactly.
Now, film, on the other hand, is a director's medium.
You're the composition man.
Because I can record that actor's performance. I can, you know, get different takes of that actor's performance, and then I can get in the editing room with the editor and decide which one I like.
Mm-hmm.
The actor doesn't get that choice. I do.
Right.
And you know, so you know, I have a little bit more. Yes, it sounds like I'm a control freak, doesn't it?
Well, I'm afraid to some extent you have to be. I mean, from the vantage point of it being your concept,
right.
And you know, it's almost fun to think of doing something that truly exhibits the passion of the director on stage. In a cinematic sense, the way you tell the actor, okay, and when you're done with this scene, I want you to walk into that purple frame on the left and just freeze. That'll be the end of you. You're doing it with a camera.
I'm going to remember that. That's good. I like that. Yeah.
Sort of inspired by the notion of course acting comedy.
Yes, that's great. Yeah. So, and that's, you know, that's why I've always wanted to really be a director. And when I moved back into directing, which was in 2007, we started doing films. Formed the company with the idea of two major things. The first one was within 5 years to shoot a feature film. Well, we're a little behind that, but that's okay. You know, objectives always change so we're a little behind that. And the second one was to provide jobs for people, jobs that actually paid people.
Yes. Noble cause there.
Well, I mean, first of all,
especially for us broke artists. Yes.
Well, and not really, because if I can provide jobs for people, it means I can keep doing it, which means I get to do what I want to do.
Oh, so. A selfish motivation.
Yeah,
yes.
So, I mean,
even the Republicans will like you then.
So,
perish the thought.
And so it's why it's one of the things I've wanted to do. And you know, it started out, I was not able to pay people. You know, I'd be surprised if any first, and when I say first time filmmaker, I seriously mean first time. I don't mean you know because you know you hear people say something about an actress that, you know, like Jennifer Lawrence, you know, she comes out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not true.
Right. Or the idea of somebody walking up to you and going, what's it like being an overnight success?
Right, exactly.
Somebody you got a punch on the mouth because it's been a long night, right?
Yeah, so, you know, so I basically, those are the two things. And gradually over time, I've begun to pay more and more people. And the two shorts that we just did, everybody on those two shorts was paid.
I love the fact that you're doing short stories because I'm a short story writer and I like seeing that passion brought to film.
Well, I like short.
That can be much more powerful than a lengthy piece.
If you know how to do it right.
Right.
A lot of people don't. A lot of people try to direct those short stories like their features.
Yeah, right.
You can usually tell because you watch it and you go, this is about 15 minutes way too long.
Right.
And it's a 20-minute movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And gotcha. Actually, a guy named Nick Beery, who is a filmmaker.
I've had him on. Yes.
Yep, we know
him. One of my short films, I sent him a I sent him, what do you think of this, Nick? And he sends me back and he says, it's really boring.
Yeah, he does tend to tell it like it is.
And
I was like,
crap, what am I going to do? I just shot this. I just spent all kinds of money shooting this movie. So I watch it, and he said, but he gave me one thing. He said, you need to go back and look at it again and try to figure out. Because he said there was kind of too much going on. It was a 29, at that point, it was like 29 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's boring because it doesn't have a focus. And I said, all right. So that was a really nice lesson for me because I went back and I just said, what's the focus? And I said, it's this character.
And you just hone it in.
Well, and I cut 9 minutes out of the film.
Woohoo.
Yeah. And
you were pleased with what you
did? Absolutely. It's a much better film. I said, you're right. So this is who it's about. It's about Maxine. So everything has to focus on Maxine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 9 minutes, one of the, I cut out the cinematographer's favorite shot.
Oh, how'd you get by with that?
I said, dude, it just doesn't, you know, it's a beautiful shot. It's a really beautiful shot. We actually have it on the DVD on like extras so you can see the shot. But it didn't do anything. It didn't help serve Maxine's point. So and then there was this subplot that also didn't help Maxine's point. I completely cut out that, and that was right in the middle of that subplot. So there was no way to salvage it. So you know, I cut out a couple. There's a supporting character that was really a great character, and the actress that played it was really wonderful, Jennifer Rosoli. But again, Maxine, which was played by Melissa Lozoff.
All right.
Have you guys ever had her?
She's name is familiar. No, I haven't.
Movie
had her
Makers.
Ah.
She does a young adult.
If you're listening, darling, just give me a call.
Okay. Or
reach me at claudioarts.com.
but it just didn't serve the plot for Maxine. It helped to develop Yolanda Moore, which was Jennifer's mm-hmm. character, and so I cut out most of that
wow.
subplot, and 9 minutes, and it hurt. You know, you're looking at your baby and going, that's practically 1/3 of the movie. Oof. That I just went, what? Because it ended up being about 21 minutes.
Gotcha. Wow.
So, but it's a much better film. And editors, and I think, one short films really, really make you focus on the story because you don't have time to mess around.
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons, I say I'm a short story writer. I'm working on a novel, but it's almost like chapters that are short stories mm-hmm. becoming a novel. Mm-hmm. Or like Ray Bradbury when he did The Illustrated Man. Oh. It was a collection of short stories that he didn't know what to do with and tried to publish it as short stories, but it wouldn't sell. So he linked it all together as a novel and it sold. So, but it's the whole idea of tattoos coming alive. I was actually friends with Ray for 10 years. We were correspondents back and forth.
Oh, my gosh.
And have his blessings on some of my own short stories, very much inspired by him. He was an early inspiration. Mm-hmm. But the reason, one of the things I learned about short stories, and if you can't be, I was looking for an even more concise form. You know, language mm-hmm. can only take you so far. You can be as poetic as you can in your choice of words, but if you really want to be even more brief, there's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used the Edgar Allan Poe rhyming format to tell stories in that spirit. Mm-hmm. So I went from one medium to another purely for the reason of being concise.
Right, yeah.
And that's what I love about short words.
Yeah. Have you ever watched a short film that's, like 6 minutes long and the opening credits are 90 seconds?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah, right.
I want to stand up and go, let's cut this part.
Yep. Yes. Absolutely.
Because, it's like, why are you doing this? And especially when
ego
it's...
Ego trip. That's where they're doing
it. Yeah, well, especially
exactly.
when... Or, they especially when the credits are, like, over black.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be music.
Right.
And then it'll be, 90 seconds of, the slow fade in of the director's name. Slow fade out.
Oh, Lord,
for 90 seconds.
Yeah.
And you're like... Yeah, that's everybody makes mistakes like that, though. But
anybody just tuning in, you're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here in the studio with Bob Crowley as my co-host and director Michael Babbitt. That's with two T's on the end.
Two T's.
I made that mistake this morning.
Any relation to the metal?
To the what?
To the metal.
Well, someone, was it Andrew Neil? Chapel Hill Comics, I think yep. it was Andrew, coined the term Babbittonium, because I used to go in there all the time.
Yeah.
And like the Sanatrium in Vegas?
Yeah. Well, there is a thing called Babbitt Metal.
Yeah,
it's used in bearings.
Yeah, exactly. But so he, and I actually told him that when he coined the phrase. I was like, it actually really is a metal.
Mm-hmm. Big shout out to my, let me finish my little lingo here I get scolded.
Yes, dear.
I want to mention the Historic Carolina Theater of Durham is my underwriter. They just finished the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, which was extraordinary. Also want to shout out to the Apex Arts Council, my
Yay.
Other underwriter. And, of course, Bob is the president of that, and he's sitting here as my assistant today when Rocco can't make it. And Rocco, I almost called you Rocco. I thought we'd go to a theater moment and give the folks mud in your eye, and you can do whatever promos you need to do, and then I'll get back with Michael Babbitt talking about his movies.
Thanks.
Okay,
you're off the air, bud. I'm still on, but you're off.
Yep.
All right. Go ahead and give them mud in your eye. This is a piece I wrote about Katrina wiping out New Orleans. Mud in your eye. I've been keeping abreast of the storm's raging quest from a bar in the French Quarter of town. While the gales from the west were all doing their best to hail the apocalyptic Katrina aground. Now there's mud in the eye of the sailor tonight, where broken levees have leveled the shore. And with the warnings all out and the natives in flight, the Big Easy ain't easy no more. When the waters rose as high as an elephant's eye, and knives of wind ceased their cutting about, an eerie silence would sigh as the night gave a cry to the voodoo of time running out. All the souls in despair who felt abandoned by care, and whom misfortune did not allow to depart, questioned country and state in this quagmire of fate, and found it best a debatable heart. A generosity grew from much more than a few who accomplished what politicians could not. But before this was true, an unrest would ensue among the ravaged whom time had forgot. A dead body neglect
From the governing sect is the talk of all our daily news. With rivers as streets and all disquieting feats, New Orleans is neck deep in her blues. It's a primitive take when your town is a lake, not to mention the neighboring states. There are strange things afloat in a hat and a coat, all abandoned to partisan traits. At Johnny White's on Bourbon Street, we drank warm beer and spooned canned meat, while Lake Pontchartrain cut a brand new loop and turned a cultural gumbo into toxic soup. It was helter-skelter in a stadium for shelter, where Americans were called refugees. They arrived in great number from a wind that drew thunder and took comfort where there was no aim to please. With a sailboat for a penthouse that drowned out the church mouse, the hurricane blew in some very sad ends. We paid for our choices with ever-weakening voices, resting far too easy on political trends. A government of the rich is a cancerous itch, and reminder that we have all sinned. Like Bob Dylan would say with his nomadic sway, the answer is blowing in the wind. A president touting religion as a special interest stool pigeon may be facing a rising of tides. Ceasing arrogance not, he may soon face his lot, in whom true power and justice resides. Chaos and creation, known as civilization, are subject to a shifting imbalance ashore. A maligned collective neglect always leads to regret. And the Big Easy ain't easy.
And that was Claudio and Mud in Your Eye. And I'd like to remind everyone you're listening to Community Radio for Carrboro Chapel Hill, WCOM 103.5 FM. And now let's hear from another voice.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
No, we can't go back. We refuse.
Okay.
So what about that?
Be that way. See if I care.
Michael, I think you were mentioning while we were listening to that. Oh, by the way, the music on that was Jim Beckwith, whose music I absolutely love. He's a jazz artist, but he's also very good at world music. He was playing a guitar, sitar, and on keys. It was amazing what he backed me up with on that, because the writing was mine, but I let him come up with these. I don't like telling artists what to do. I just give them a flavor and say,
right,
show me what you got, and if I like it, we
right.
go with it.
Right.
That's how this works.
It's good collaboration. I like the music in it, because it's very primitive.
Yes, that was the idea.
It was kind of, not really primitive, but primal, I guess is more the word I'm looking for.
We decided not to play Love Story while I was doing it.
You know, you were telling me about some films that you just saw, that you got a new appreciation of independent documentary film. Or
actually, it was The Ninth Wonder, hip-hop. There was a fellow that goes by under the title of The Ninth Wonder, who did this amazing, you know, I've sort of listened to hip-hop in the past. It's not been a big thing with me. I've never really followed the genre and never really bothered to educate myself on what the genre is. But The Ninth Wonder is actually teaching it at Harvard of all things. And I sat down and I watched this film because I was stage manager at Full Frame, and I was completely taken by it. He points out how literature was made to be a part of it, and you know how it was like little snippets, which seems to be how you get the attention span these days. It's no longer the full lengthy thing because they're going to cut you off after the first 3 or 4 minutes. So make sure that what you do get them to hear is potent and get your point across. And I started understanding
like short films.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. That's why I'm so glad that medium is finally getting attention, because you know it's a lot of short stories have been turned into major motion pictures. Mm-hmm. In some cases, done well. In many cases, done poorly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you extend something because you really like this plot and you decide, oh, I've got to make this 20 more chapters. It wasn't meant to be in some cases.
Right? Yeah.
You had a quick question of me that you mentioned something about while we were talking.
Oh, yeah. Are you talking about I'd like to hear how you managed to get Joan Baez's autograph.
Well, I told you.
I know, and I want you to tell me again.
Oh, did I not tell it on air? No. Oh, I thought for some reason I thought I told it on air.
No, I think it's too awesome to spill to the pass secrets up.
Ah, okay. Going back to the autograph situation.
And all of you guys out there right now going, Joan Baez doesn't give autographs. Well, I got a story for you right here.
And if I have actually said this earlier on, for some reason, I guess we've had so many conversations already that I assumed I actually told this on air.
Nope.
But here it is again, and I apologize if I have already mentioned this on the show, but everybody tells me I haven't. Years ago, I was, this is more than a decade ago, I was sous chef at a place called Luma's Macrobiotic Vegetarian Gourmet Restaurant. And on one particular evening, it was a movie star hangout, on 22nd and 9th in New York. I was living in Brooklyn Heights at the time. this particular evening, we had Yoko Ono, Sean Lennon, Madonna, Lenny Kravitz, Joan Baez, and one or two others that I can't remember, all sitting at a table. They were composing an album against the war in the Persian Gulf, which is kind of what you'd expect Joan to be involved in. And at the end of the dinner, Joan Baez came back into the kitchen to thank me for doing a particularly good job on her macrobiotic vegetarian cuisine. Before I worked there, I didn't really know what that was. I just decided to, you know, expand my horizons as a chef and go into this genre. But she came back in, and she was wearing an old Bob Dylan sailor jacket that she had obviously gotten from her romance with Bob Dylan many, probably a decade or more before. And my entire drive at the time she was thanking me was to ask her for her autograph. But something blocked me and told me, no, that wouldn't be cool. Just enjoy this moment. She's just coming back to give you a big hug. Soak it up with your crew, not leave it alone. Even though I really wanted to get that autograph because I love her music. I've loved her since, you know, I first listened to her many moons ago. But I left it alone. A decade later, I'm working as a stage manager at the Carolina Theater, and we were doing a sound check. Joan Baez was singing. She comes there, I think, frequently. It's an annual thing now, pretty much. And at the end of the sound check, I walked up to her and I said, I wonder if I might get your autograph. And she looked at me as though I just put poison in the tea and said, no, I appreciate it, but I don't do that. Turns out I'd seen a documentary before produced by, what is the name of that director? He did a Bob Dylan thing. Just did sort of the life story of Bob Dylan.
Scorsese?
Scorsese, thank you. And I remember a scene in there in which Bob Dylan was totally against autographs. Like, who are we to think that we should, you know, anybody should deserve our autograph or that we should deserve to write them. He didn't like the hierarchy of it, was totally against it. Well, Joan was the same way, and I was getting this lecture live on stage. I figured, okay, I'd walk away from it, but there's a persistent side to me. I was halfway off the stage, and I remembered her coming back into the kitchen a decade before, thanking me for the food. And I thought I'd try one more time. I turned around, I walked up to her. I said, Joan, I wonder if you remember a particular night at Luma's Vegetarian Macrobiotic Gourmet Restaurant. It's the longest title since Monty Python. on 22nd and 9th, and you came back into the kitchen, blah, blah, and I ran her through the whole scenario. And I said, I was the chef, the sous chef, actually, that you were coming to thank that night because I had prepared your dish. And she looked me up and down. I could see her imagining me in white, you know, chef uniform. He goes, that was you, wasn't it? I said, yeah, I don't think I could make this up. And I said, and she says, yeah, I remember that. I said, well, I'm wondering, will that do me any good to get your autograph? And she just looked at me and she says, Claudio! I said, okay. And I started walking off the stage. And I was just about to turn the corner into the ante room. And she goes, Claudio, get me a Pepsi and I'll sign the damn thing. So I got her autograph. And I don't think very many people have her autograph.
You just need a little chutzpah.
That's it. Finally got it.
And you need to know how to be a sous chef.
I guess so, yeah.
In a restaurant that has a name longer than Monty Python.
And apparently, you know, thinking about getting it 10 years before was not a good idea, but using that to get it later worked.
Right. You knew that was going to happen.
You left a good taste in her mouth.
Oh.
Yeah, let's... Yeah. No. Anyway.
I think that's an awesome story. That's got to be in a play somewhere. You need to
might have to work that in.
I mean, it
real life.
You know, yeah, yeah. It doesn't have to be. You know, for the play, you might want to make up the artist who it was or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, but
it needs to be grand opera.
That sounds like a moment that should happen in a play somewhere or something like that, or even in a film.
Yeah, because it was definitely a little inspiration in my life. I have to say that the fact that I finally got it, she just showed some heart. So saw this guy that she knew she liked the cuisine of, and then.
She might have
decided
been,
not to turn me down.
She might have been flirting a little, you know.
So thank you, Joan Baez. And there's another little scenario that I thought would be interesting to add to this, and that is I spent a decade of my life as a chef on private yachts and schooners in the Caribbean, South America, Cozumel, whatever boat was good, you know. It was my way of being a traveling chef. I have a very adventurous soul, so I would find out what yacht was going where, based out of Fort Lauderdale, and I would try to get a gig on the yacht that was going to some place I wanted to explore anyway. And this was how I sort of bounced around. But I'm going in this direction because we had Joan Baez's music as part of the library on the yacht's cassettes back in those days. And the one thing that I remember very distinctly is Joan Baez's voice is not something you want to hear when you go out to sea. If you're not inclined to be seasick, Joan Baez's voice will get you there. And so there was this caution, you know. Everybody had her music in their library, but
nobody played
once,
it.
Once underway, we did not play. We played it when you were tied to the dock, but right. Not while you were underway. Something about her voice and your stomach at sea. I don't know. I don't know how to explain this. Interesting phenomenon, but only her voice accomplished that.
We gotta get a government grant and study that.
Yes, there we go. Study Joan Baez's voice.
I think it's Dos Equis, but have they been following you around for a while?
Dos Equis?
Yeah.
I kind of like it if they were.
Those commercials about the world's most interesting man, are those really based on your life?
I got to go watch these commercials.
Oh, yeah.
Is it in Dos Equis?
Yeah, it's Dos Equis.
Somebody's been watching.
Stay thirsty, my friend.
I don't have any sort of like, I don't get any money from Dos Equis every time I say their name.
Yeah,
I
but just, maybe we could. You know.
Yeah, let's begin this.
Sponsorship.
Yeah, right, there we
Please
go.
Please call us now.
Indeed. Well, let's bounce back to your life in the movies. Right. How many films did you say you have right now? I know most of them are shorts, but aren't you working on something that's
We're working on a
full length, right?
I think over the course of my life, I've probably shot more than a dozen short films. Although that number's going to actually greatly increase over the next 6 months because one a month is pretty ambitious. We've done two so far. We shoot our next one. We're going to get a little bit behind with the next one because we shoot it in the beginning of May, so it won't be out until near the end of May.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the chance to do that a lot has really been exciting because, you know, things are always changing. It's going to be good practice for the feature.
How are you getting this funded, if I may ask?
The feature?
Mm-hmm.
Investment.
All right. Good.
We are a large enough budget that at being an independent filmmaker, you get to learn some very interesting things once you take certain steps, as, you know, like just size of budget. The larger you get, like when you go over $250,000 for a budget, you're seeking investments, you now fall under the privy of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So there are a lot of legalities that you can get in trouble with if you don't do it the right way. Which, if you don't hire a lawyer, will definitely get you in jail. So, and then you have...
The only people that get away with anything anymore are the ones that already have too much anyway.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. So that's been interesting to learn. And so, with our budget and with us going for investors, there are certain people that we can ask and certain people we can't. If I talk, I can't ask certain people for money. Otherwise, I go to jail because the Securities and Exchange Commission protects people like that. So it's, you know, it's a, you know, there are a lot of rules that you don't necessarily know. And if you go into it blind, yeah, you might get away with it, but do you really want to risk it? And, you know, I've never been one of these filmmakers. I know you hear a lot of the romanticized stories about filmmakers who do whatever it takes to get their film made. I don't really want to end up in jail for mine.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a political activist, so my pieces don't necessarily – I mean, I like my pieces to be provocative.
And projection's not very good in those films.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's not.
You're supposed to suffer for your art now. You know?
Yeah, I've I'm almost 50, so I've suffered a long time for my art.
There we go.
And, you know, I don't want to add jail to it as well.
Yeah, I don't think I'd have any use for jail.
Yeah. No. So, and, you know, and so I, you know, want to, you want to be careful about things like that. And so there are just certain things that we started to discover. And then, you know, we added things like, the film is going to be a SAG film.
So you're bringing in the union.
Yeah, well.
Does that mean every actor has to have a union card?
No, that means.
This is a right to work state, I might remind.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is. And,
we'll look for the union label.
I don't know.
Dos Equis.
This is actually a hot button for me, the union thing. Okay. I'm telling people right now that if I have to be involved with the actual union aspect of things in the next film that I have, that this, The Endless Whispers, will be the first and last union film I do.
I can empathize.
It has been so difficult, and there's an atmosphere that of not Big Brother, because that's like they're watching you, but it's not that. But it's this atmosphere. I mean, they can take away my film at any time based on a rule that the basic agreement for SAG is 850 pages long. And I've read and that's just the basic agreement. And I've read the whole thing. But there's obviously no way that I'm gonna know the whole thing.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, and if you screw up one of those rules, and an actor, and let's face it, you know, our film, the Endless Whispers, we've got a larger cast because it's more of an ensemble piece.
Mm-hmm, okay.
So there's a larger cast. I don't know all these actors like intimately. You know, they're people that have auditioned for me. I've liked them. We work together with each other on a day, and you know, I'm assuming, and I'm making the assumption that they're professionals. But if one of them reports something that I don't necessarily know about, SAG can come down, walk on the set, and say, "You need to either pay these people this, or we're going to shut the feature down."
How is it you got locked in with him in the first place?
Well, a friend and someone that's been in my past films is a SAG actor. And I respect him a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to do this. This was something I thought, well, we'll make this step. And so I decided to do it. And I'm somebody that when I commit to something, and I did research and I knew there were going to be some, you know, there were going to be issues. I wasn't really clear on how much, but I did understand that there would be issues. It was just like the SEC thing and the lawyers. I realized, you know, this is something that I've committed to do, so I need to do it. And once we cast the show, which we had to cast the show early because of the shorts, normally I wouldn't be casting until actually next month, but we actually had to cast in early January because I wanted to get an ensemble, and each of those actors was then going to be in their own short. And I couldn't just cast, like, the first short we did, I'll cast that actor. And then
right.
Because then I wouldn't get an ensemble piece of people that kind of fit.
I gotcha.
So I had to, and two of the actors that I wanted to cast were SAG actors. And so, you know, we went ahead and did it, made the decision to do it. And now that we've made the decision, signed them, you know, the agreement is, and, you know, we based all the budgetary information, especially for the talent, off of the SAG contracts. And I'm even, you know, I was even at a point where I was waffling between, you know, should I just let this go? It's so difficult. Just let this go. So that's not something we don't have to deal with. And, but we will still maintain the modified low budget SAG.
Sure.
Contract idea concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll still do everything but I just don't have to deal with this likelihood of, you know, that there might be something I don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even more frustrating when you have questions and you call the SAG office and you say, here's my needs. Here's what we're planning on doing. Am I breaking any rules here?
Oh, boy.
And they say, we'll get back with you. And so in the meantime, you know, a lot of, you know, I've already laid out because I read the basic agreement.
Right.
I also read the modified low budget agreement.
Was this before or after War and Peace?
It is War and Peace.
I believe you.
I don't feel like I have to reread War and Peace now that I've read that. But, you know, and so they come back and 7 days later, 7 days, to tell me one small change.
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, okay, that's great. And then, but I'm like, it took you 7 days to tell me that? So you guys don't even know this contract as well as you should, because why would it take you 7 days to figure to figure that out?
When you have an urgent need for this information.
Right. And, you know, so I was like, well, okay. So you know, there just been a lot of things like that. And we did the first two shorts were actually the two shorts that had the SAG actors in them. So they were both under SAG as well. So during the second one, we've hired our line producer, Pamela Smith, who is actually, speaking of, right now getting ready to leave to go to New York to do a SAG workshop on contracts.
We've got about four more minutes left. We can go on and consider yourself part of the Speakeasy family at this point. We'll have you on again to follow up. But we've got about 4 minutes left to wrap things up. So give us the contact information one more time where people can see or get an idea of your films.
Yeah, I just want to push The Endless Whispers, though, a little bit. So
yes,
The Endless Whispers is our featured film. It's a film that we have spent over 2.5 years working on. We have information on our website, which is theendlesswhispers.com. If you like H.P. Lovecraft, if you like thriller horror films in the vein of more 70s and 80s type horror films like Halloween and The Shining and Rosemary's Baby and Alien and things like that, you'll like this film. It's not a modern day horror film type.
When are we expecting the release date on this?
We're hoping for May of 2015.
All right.
Fantastic.
Somewhere here.
And
here.
But what I'll do is I'll stay in touch with you about it so we can promote it between now and then, and we'll have you on again.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe you'll have Claudio in one of your films by then.
Yeah, well, he might be in this one.
There you go. My co-host has taken my manager position here.
Yeah. Some of the shorts, actually, there are some roles that
I would love to work with
you. Sure.
Absolutely.
There you go.
So give us all the contact information one more time.
Theendlesswhispers.com, that's the website. My personal website is at bombshellstudios.com. And my email address, if you're interested in any aspect of this whatsoever, is michael@bombshellstudios.com.
And if you've forgotten everything, just go to claudioarts.com and ask me, and I'll tell you something.
Excellent.
If I don't know it, I'll make it up.
Yeah, that's good. I'm good with that.
Yeah, good, cool.
I'm a filmmaker. We make things up.
Listen, it's been fantastic having you on, buddy.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate coming on. It's been really neat.
It's been absolute fun, and again, this is going to be a continuing saga.
That sounds great.
And thanks for my coffee this morning.
You're welcome.
Guy comes on my radio show and asks me what I take in my coffee. Now, that's class.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bob didn't tell me what he wanted, otherwise I'd have
brought
his own, too.
You didn't know Bob was here. I didn't tell you.
I always put brandy in it anyway.
Lack of courtesy on my
part.
That's
my kind of man. That's about the only thing I'd put in my coffee.
Yeah. Well, this is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater signing off. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you,
Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks out there, for tuning in. Until next time, cheers.